From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is under the weather again today. But earlier this week, Terry talked with writer Peter Schneider about some of the darker and more absurd consequences of German reunification. We'll hear that interview on this edition of Fresh Air. An earlier upheaval in Germany was the background to one of Broadway's most popular shows, Cabaret. Today, we meet the man who wrote the music for Cabaret, composer John Kander. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Frankie and Johnny, starring Al Pacino and Michelle Pfeiffer. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Secretary of State James Baker warned today that preparations for a Middle East peace conference may be threatened by attempted disruptions from terrorists and extremists. Before a meeting today with Palestinian negotiators, Baker said that he had highly classified information about a potential terrorist danger, but he provided no details. The secretary is scheduled to leave Saturday night for another Middle East tour to complete arrangements for the proposed conference. He said that he didn't want to suggest that yesterday's takeover of six Arab homes in East Jerusalem by Jewish settlers was the kind of incident he had in mind. He said he agreed with Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, who called the action a mistake. In response to continuing violence against foreigners in Germany, the Bonn government has taken drastic steps to lower the number of refugees coming into the country. Deirdre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
Applications for political asylum in Germany will now be decided upon within 6 weeks, according to an agreement among Germany's major political parties. The applicants will be housed in large refugee camps until their case is decided. Currently, it can take several years before a court decides to approve or reject an application, and refugees often live illegally to avoid deportation. Politicians in Bonn hope the tightened measures will reduce the yearly number of refugees and the public perception that too many foreigners are coming into the country. But human rights groups have voiced doubts about the legality and effectiveness of the new measures. For National Public Radio, this is Deirdre Berger in Frankfurt.
About 1,700 Cuban communists are assembled in the port city of Santiago for a party congress, but a news blackout is keeping the Cuban people in the dark about the proceedings. George Guetta has the story.
At the last congress held in 1986, there was extensive live coverage and scores of foreign delegates and foreign journalists were in attendance. This time, no foreigners were invited, and after live broadcast coverage of the ceremonial opening, the congress went into closed session. The Cuban media has been billing the meeting as the most important the country has had in this century. The delegates are assembled at a time of economic crisis, and the unanswered question is whether President Fidel Castro and his party are amenable to reform measures to revitalize the economy. Castro has pledged to stay the socialistic course, but some analysts believe he is more open to change than he has admitted publicly. For National Public Radio, I'm George Guetta at the State Department.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street after a late rally that was led by the blue chip stocks. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 30 points to close at 2,976.52. Advances edged declines in active trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 164 million shares. The Dow Jones Industrials closed once again after gaining 30 points. This is NPR News. Labor Secretary Lynn Martin said today that the Clarence Thomas case has brought the issue of sexual harassment out into the open. Martin is a strong supporter of the Supreme Court nominee and heads a group called Women for Judge Thomas. She said today that most working women have been subjected to some form of sexual harassment. Term limits on California legislators were upheld today by the state Supreme Court. The measure, which limits the length of time a state senator or assembly member can remain in office, was approved by the voters in last November's election. From Los Angeles, NPR's Wendy Kaufman has more.
In a 6-1 decision, California Supreme Court ruled that Proposition 140 did not unduly restrict a legislator's right to run for office or a voter's right to choose a candidate. The proposition limits state senators to 2 4-year terms and assembly members to 3 2-year terms. The court said any such restrictions are outweighed by the state's interest in protecting against an entrenched dynastic legislative bureaucracy. The ruling is the first by any court in the country on the validity of statewide legislative term limits. Both Oklahoma and Colorado have similar term-limiting measures, but neither has been tested in court. Proponents of term limits argue it creates a more responsive citizen-type legislature. Opponents contend term limits will result in even more power in the hands of special interest groups. In Los Angeles, this is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
U.S. Trade Representative Carla Hills said today that the Bush administration has begun an investigation into the effects of Chinese barriers on U.S. trade. In July, President Bush promised to take action against China's alleged unfair trading practices. He said that if the Chinese failed to commit themselves to improving market access for American business, the administration would take action. Today, Hills said China's response has been unsatisfactory. She said the investigation, which could take as much as a year, will determine whether trade retaliation would be justified. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, filling in for Terry Gross. October 3rd was the first anniversary of German reunification, but the celebration has been marred by recent attacks against foreigners. Last week, a hotel for refugees was firebombed, leaving 2 Lebanese girls severely burned. 3 skinheads were arrested. Nearly 200,000 foreigners are expected to pour into Germany this year. The rise of German racism began in eastern Germany, where unemployment is very high and has spread across the country. Earlier this week, Terry Gross spoke with political essayist and novelist Peter Schneider. Schneider is from Berlin, but is visiting this country to give a series of university lectures about Germany since reunification. A collection of his writings called The German Comedy, Scenes of Life After the Wall, has just been published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Schneider also contributes to Harper's Magazine and The New York Times. Schneider told Terry Gross that the extremist attacks are not just against foreigners, but anyone perceived as different.
It would be a very sad result if this coming down of our wall of concrete would create a new wall between the purely Germans, the so-called pure Germans, and the rest of the world. It won't happen, I must say that, because the vast majority in Germany, East as West, the vast majority is shocked by this, and they go against this. There are the groups who are really literally protecting night and day the homes of the silent. This is not said in America, but it has to be said. There's a lot of activity going on against this. There are demonstrations. Now, even politicians finally show up. They have been urged by the public. Why aren't you going there? People asked. They're politicians, and now they show up there. So I do think that we are fit to wipe out this extremism, but it is a real danger.
Since there must be so many people in Germany who strongly oppose the kind of racism and xenophobia and homophobia that's growing now in Germany, what kind of action is being taken to stop it?
My problem is here. I really I feel very angry because the politicians limit themselves mostly to argue we must find a way to stop the stream of refugees. And there's a problem. We have had a stream of refugees. I think we have taken 500,000 foreigners only last year, and more than 800,000 from East Germany. So this is an enormous amount of people. It would mess up every economy, and there's a problem. There's no question about that. But it is right to discuss how to stop this number of refugees to come, and it is a problem for all over Europe. Other countries even behave worse than Germany in this, and which is no consolation. I was completely upset about the Italians, what they did with the Albanese. I think this was outrageous, and they were lucky that there was a putsch in Moscow because the public interest, the world interest, jumped to this other spot. anyway, the main problem seems to me that we need clear, very clear signs now from our politicians and from the civic society that we want to live with foreigners, that we want these foreigners that live with us for many years, for generations, and that, of course, we keep on taking a certain number of foreigners as much as we can. There must be the statement, because the message that comes across, if you only talk about how can you stop this, is we have too many anyway, and actually also the politicians would like to have everybody out of here. And the extremists then feel kind of justified. They think, okay, they talk about it, we do it.
Have you or anyone close to you been attacked?
Yes, not I myself, but people that I know, yes.
What were the circumstances?
He was just a friend who, he's an homosexual, he walked across Berlin. He was in a neighborhood that was, it was not a good place to go. If you know Berlin, he didn't know it very well. And he was approached by a gang and he was completely beaten up.
Peter, I was wondering if you were Jewish. I ask that because most of the people I know in America with the name Schneider are Jewish. I know it's a German name, but, to my ears, it's almost always someone who's Jewish. I ask that because if you were Jewish, I was wondering why your family stayed.
No, I'm not Jewish, but I have a lot of Jewish friends. I always had them in Berlin. Among artists, it's easier than elsewhere to find Jewish people. And I know. I think I know a little bit how they feel about this.
And how?
Well, they feel alarmed, and rightly so. They are not the first one to be attacked now. But of course, there have been vandalization of Jewish cemeteries. There have been clear signs of anti-Semitism. And of course, there is a mood coming back, which I think what I called in my book the narcissistic anti-Semitism, which is a little more complicated. I think the main point here is that there are a certain number of Germans who hate Jews for the fact that Jews remind them to this unique crime that the Germans did against Jews. And there's a anti-Semitism that wants to remove the Jew from the German self-esteem. Just go out of my way, you endanger my self-esteem. This is the logic of the thing. And there are many Germans who don't want to be reminded all the time, they feel, and this is dangerous.
So you think a lot of Germans don't want to be reminded of the Holocaust and the presence of Jews reminds them of it, and they don't like that.
Yeah, they think this is, of course, we have to do it, one has to do it. It is like a duty which you don't like. And, of course, it is not something comfortable to do. Who could deny that? It has to be done. I even go so far, young people have to be urged to be confronted with this past.
You know, I'm thinking, your book is titled The German Comedy. So far, nothing that we've talked about is very funny or ironic at all. Do you think that the tone has really changed since you started writing the book? You know, the tone of life in Germany?
Well, I would always try to tell stories more than to reflect in my writing. I like to reflect by telling stories, and that what makes my book entertaining and a good read. As a matter of fact, you can even, about very bitter things, you can tell funny stories, as we know. And there is a tragic comic aspect in this, how things are now. I mean, West Germany, it always pretended to want unification, and now the East Germans somehow have called the bluff, or Gorbachev has called the bluff, whoever. And now they complain that their highest desire is fulfilled. There's something tragicomic in this.
If you're just joining us, my guest is German writer Peter Schneider. He lives in Berlin. He's the author of the new book, The German Comedy, Scenes of Life After the Wall. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Peter Schneider, author of the new book, The German Comedy, Scenes of Life After the Wall. So how often do you go to East Germany, to East Berlin?
I go very often. Actually, I rediscover East Berlin. And not only East Berlin, the whole environment, the whole area around. You know, we could always do it. We could have done this before, but it was very complicated and uncomfortable. You always felt like something really uncomfortable could happen. The police was a Nazi kind of police. And you just didn't want to have to do with them. And that's why, although we could have done it, we didn't do it. And only now we discover that this is a wonderful place, Berlin, that you have lakes all around. I was driving with my kids every weekend to another lake. And some of them are really clean. I was astonished. And in a way, it is like rediscovering your youth, because the small towns, the lakes, the landscape, just for a lack of money, has not so much been ruined as it was in West Germany. And many things are like untouched. I have seen a lake, Stechlinsee, which is something I wouldn't believe it would still exist. It's like a lake, you know, that I would have found, it seems like centuries ago.
Is the culture of East Germany really different than what you're used to in West Germany?
It depends on what...
Why don't we talk about Berlin?
Yeah. Well, yeah, it depends. If we take culture in a very large sense, in daily life, means daily life, there's an enormous difference, of course, between East and West Berliners. We have not only two cities and two mayors and two Olympic game sports halls and so on. We have also two sorts of Berliners. There's enormous difference in cultural life and the way they feel and the way even they speak and think. Especially in the way they, what they understand about democracy and about society, they are different. We have to say that, and we have to accept it as a fact. But we have to deal with it without arrogance. I can give you an example of this problem. We have an enormous holding company now in East Germany that is dismantling 8,000 former states companies. And this holding company, of course, has an enormous power. It is an enormous bureaucracy. And by the way, it was a big mistake to have just one of holding company like this and not many in every single of these new provinces. Anyway, but most East Germans see that holding company just as a other version of a communist party. They project their experience, their life experience, that their life is ruled by a foreign power, a rapist power, a power that doesn't care for people and does everything for himself. This experience is projected now towards the West, and I must say, of course, they are always think that fit this image. So it's a very complicated process. There are people who literally say this is a new dictatorship. The West Germany is just a new dictatorship as bad as we had before. It will take years to come to break into this logic, into this mentality, and break these wrong projections and these harsh experiences.
Do you have any people who you're fairly close to who live in East Berlin?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I have many friends, and they, what I tell you is makes part of this experience with my friends.
You wrote in your book that a lot of East Germans, when they go to the West, complain that the West is cold, that people lack true friendship and solidarity. It's a real rat race. People believe that money is everything.
Yeah.
And what does that mean to you, that they're saying that, that that's their reaction?
Well, they say exactly that. Money is everything. And they even go so far and say, so how could we expect you to help us since money for you is everything and it doesn't pay off if you give us any money? They even, you know, believe it in this way, that they are completely astonished why we pay any penny for them. And if we do, there must be some economic reason that is not understandable right now. This makes things very harsh. And of course, it's always a stress even for yourself. I mean, you have to find the answer. I mean, you being an American, it's not so easy to say money is not everything. Of course, there's always something true in this. And this could be the good part of the debate, that everybody has to be put in question and that we could also learn from this being questioned. As a matter of fact, my feeling is that West Germans don't want to learn.
They don't want to learn what?
They don't want to be put in question. They are the victors of this 40-year-old battle. And I must say that many behave also as victors do. We should rethink our own history, and we should always have present the question, would we, the West Germans, under Stalinist rule, would we have done any better? It was just luck on which side of the Elbe you have lived, whether you became a Democrat and whether you became wealthy, or whether you remained a poor, repressed communist or anti-communist, whatsoever.
Did you ever think that the wall would be opened?
Yes, I even wrote it in the New York Times in spring 89. It was entitled, If the Wall Came Tumbling Down. I thought that the wall would come down. I never believed in unification, and to say more, I never wanted unification.
Why not?
Most West German intellectuals didn't want that, and I think that we did wrong in this. When the wall came down, I knew from the first moment that unification would come, and I started to accept it then. I didn't want it because this was this feeling of guilt, and there was also a wrong feeling of guilt. We thought, most of us thought, this is the price that the Germans have to pay for what they did in World War II. This is, of course, a wrong analysis. And by the way, it was a too comfortable analysis for Western people, because it's unfair if you say, okay, we give up on unification. We are wealthy, by the way, and we are fine. And the other side has to pay the price. For them to say we renounce on unification would have meant we keep on being the poor and the repressed. So it was actually an unfair thing not to too long for unification, and this has to be said. There's a burden there, which intellectual has to deal with that.
So now you support the idea of unification.
Yes, I did from the very first. I did actually from the very first moment, but I never wished. I never wanted it. I even wrote in this article that we had to completely give up on reunification in order to get democracy back into East Germany.
What were your fears of reunification?
The same fears that you have. And they are not completely, these fears are not completely outruled. They are not completely out of the game. The fear that Germans could become predominant in Europe, not only economically, which they have been so far, but also in political terms. And a certain side of a German character, this teacher's mentality, could become a predominant character in Europe, which is not a nice idea to me. There are fears like this, but on the other hand, I pointed out in one article that most of the classic fears, I don't deal with them so much. I think that we Germans are so much have to do with this, with our problems, and we will loosen weight within the next 10 years, that for the near future, these fears are not realistic. In the long run, of course, the fears are right, because we will be a predominant power, a superpower in Europe, and it's very much, depends very much on how we behave and how we define our role in this new Europe, whether unification is bearable.
So you're worried about the stability of democracy in your country?
I think it's a great moment, not only of Germany, it's a great moment of European history. And by the way, I think, especially we, the Germans, we should give us a little ease in living this moment. We just don't, we are not up to the challenge in our feelings. We behave like I don't know, a lamp had been broken and we have to repair something. It's an enormous moment in history. It's an enormous chance, and there's this mood of lament which is actually not up to the challenge. Anyway, it's the first moment also after 40 years that West Germany has to prove that all these values of democracy, of self-determination, of solidarity, are defended even if the cash box is not does not work out. If the cash box, I mean, if there's a loss in the cash box, we have had a democracy that was never tested, and now our allied friends are kind of fading away, disappearing. And we are responsible for ourselves. And it turns out that the politicians, they are kind of managers who learned how to manage a company, a very effective big economic machine. But they are not up to the challenge to give us an idea about what this historical moment means. And I think that there are a lot. We need a new kind of idealism. I'm not shying away from this word. We are an extreme materialistic people right now, and without a certain wanting and longing for being a unified people, we won't make it. Purely with money, it's not going to be done. We need to accept that there will be a loss for 10 years, and it is worth what it costs.
Peter Schneider, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And Peter Schneider is the author of the new book, The German Comedy, Scenes of Life After the Wall. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, sitting in for Terry Gross. Coming up, an interview with John Kander, one half of the songwriting team Kander and Ebb. Their work includes the song New York, New York, and the musical Cabaret. And can a struggling short-order cook find true love with a tough-as-nails waitress? Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Frankie and Johnny, starring Al Pacino and Michelle Pfeiffer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Supporters of Judge Clarence Thomas launched a campaign today to counter allegations of sexual harassment made by law professor Anita Hill. The Senate vote to confirm Thomas to the U.S. Supreme Court was delayed until Tuesday, after those allegations were made public this week. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Republican Senator Orrin Hatch told reporters today that the public hearings into the allegations of sexual harassment will hurt both Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill, no matter what the result.
I think neither of them is going to walk out of here a whole person. They're both going to be badly damaged. And frankly, there will always be unthinking people who will accuse both of them of impropriety.
Senator Hatch made it clear he was not approaching tomorrow's hearing with an open mind. He told reporters flatly that he believes Thomas because he's known him for so long. Hatch's press conference was immediately followed by another press conference put on by Thomas's chief supporter, Senator John Danforth. Danforth presented a dozen women who know and have worked for Thomas, who all said he would never engage in such conduct. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Also in Washington, Secretary of State James Baker met today with three Palestinian leaders. Baker leaves for the Middle East again this weekend. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli press reports say that the U.S. is determined to issue invitations to a regional peace conference during Secretary Baker's upcoming trip to the Middle East. He will try to hammer out the final details of the letter of assurances he will give both sides. Israeli analysts said that Secretary Baker invited the Palestinians to Washington, even though he could have met them in Jerusalem next week, for two reasons. They say that he wanted to show Israel that the U.S. is in control of the peace process, and he also wanted to make sure that Israel does not arrest two of the Palestinians. Before they left for Washington, Israeli police questioned Faisal Husseini and Hanan Ashrawi about whether they had broken the law by meeting with PLO officials in Algiers. They refused to say whether they had gone to Algiers. Meanwhile, Israeli peace activist A.B. Nathan today began an 18-month sentence for meeting PLO leader Yasser Arafat. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Leaders of the Yugoslav army have agreed to pull their troops out of Croatia in a month's time, while Croatian forces have agreed to lift their blockades of Federal Army barracks. This agreement, along with pledges to work out a political settlement to end the current fighting, appears to offer the best chance of stopping the factional fighting in the breakaway republic. The agreement was worked out under the leadership of the European Community. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 30 points to close at 2,976.52 in very active trading. This is NPR News. In Washington, the National Education Association announced today that it will not endorse President Bush's re-election bid, because it believes he has, in the group's words, betrayed the campaign promise that he made to be the education president. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
The NEA's 2 million members did not directly endorse George Bush's re-election bid. Its Political Action Committee unanimously concluded, though, that the Bush record on domestic and education issues was so bad, the NEA must look to another presidential candidate in 1992, NEA President Keith Geiger.
NEA cannot endorse a president who espouses support for the public schools while proposing voucher and school choice plans that would shift public monies into private schools. NEA cannot endorse a president who has proclaimed the federal government's responsibility to ensure that all children come to school ready to learn while refusing to allocate adequate funds for nutrition, health care, and preschool programs.
Geiger also denounced the president's position on the Civil Rights Restoration Bill and his veto of the Family and Medical Leave Act. The NEA has never endorsed a Republican presidential candidate or incumbent. I'm Claudia Sanchez in Washington.
According to officials of the Democratic Party, aides of New York Governor Mario Cuomo have been looking into delegate rules and deadlines for the 1992 presidential campaign. According to Lynn Cutler, vice chair of the Democratic National Committee, some of the governor's people have been telling campaign workers not to commit to other candidates. Just this week, the office of the New York governor said again that he had no plans to run in the 1992 presidential race. The government says initial claims for state unemployment insurance went up again last week. The Labor Department says that there were 435,000 new claims made last week, an increase of 5,000 from the week before. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, sitting in for Terry Gross. The songs of Candor and Ebb are being celebrated in an off-Broadway review called And the World Goes Round. Since it opened last March, the show has won a number of awards and was named the Best Musical Review of 1991 by both the Drama Desk and the Outer Critics Circle. Perhaps the most valuable endorsement came from Frank Rich, the New York Times theater critic. He raved about the show and described the Candor and Ebb aesthetic as splashy showbiz emotions, emblemized by hyperbolic anthems of survival. That kind of anthem is best epitomized by one of their most popular songs, New York, New York. In their 25-year collaboration, John Candor and Fred Ebb have written the songs for the musicals Cabaret, Chicago, The Act, Woman of the Year, and Flora, The Red Menace. Ebb writes the lyrics, Candor the music. Terry spoke with John Candor last spring shortly after And the World Goes Round opened. Before we hear their conversation, let's listen to the song that the review takes its title from. It was written for Liza Minnelli to sing in the movie New York, New York.
Sometimes you're happy and sometimes you're sad, but the world goes round. Sometimes you lose every nickel you've had, but the world goes round. Sometimes your dreams get broken pieces, but that doesn't alter a thing. Take it from me, there's still gonna be a summer, a winter, a fall, and a spring. And sometimes a friend starts treating you bad, but the world goes round.
I know in talking to Stephen Sondheim that he said he didn't think he could write songs about the context of a show. That's why he doesn't write pop tunes, because the show gives you a sense of who the characters are, what kind of music is needed.
Right.
Do you feel that way, too? I mean, you've had, like, the first song that you wrote with Fred Ebb was My Coloring Book, and that was a pop hit on the radio and everything. But after that, I think virtually all the work you've done together has been for shows. Do you think you'd be writing songs if it wasn't for the context of Broadway shows?
No, I really don't. I think that when Fred and I first started working, for the first couple of years, we, in addition to being interested in the theater, we tried writing pop songs, and a few of them got performed, but for the most part, no. So I tend to agree with Stephen. We always write in some sort of context. If it's not for a show that we're writing, then it's for maybe it's a piece of special material for a couple of ladies that we're very fond of, Cheetah Rivera and Liza Minnelli.
Now, Fred Ebb couldn't be with us today because he's doing some last-minute work on a show. There's a run-through or something. Are you used to talking without him about your work?
No, I'm not.
Does it feel awkward?
Yeah. Fred is much more articulate than I, and usually we're in a room together, and questions get addressed to the two of us, and he will answer.
That makes it easy for you, doesn't it?
Yeah, I like it that way, too.
What is your process of working together? Do you work together in the same room at the same time?
Right. Fred lives about four blocks from my house, and he likes to stay home to work. I like to go out to work. And at 10 o'clock or so in the morning, I'll go over to his house, and we will sit around the kitchen table and have some coffee and gossip a little and then go to work. And if we're working on a moment in a show, for instance, we'll be talking about the characters and the situation that we're about to musicalize. And Fred may have an idea or a phrase, and from that phrase, maybe we'll develop a rhythm. It's very hard to describe it after that except to say that we improvise together at the same time in the same room. It's a kind of unique way of working for us. Most people do not work that way. Either somebody hands somebody a melody or somebody hands somebody a lyric. That never happens to us, or almost never. And for the 26 or so years that we've been together, that's always been the way we worked. And it's always fun. I don't know how to say that without sounding goony, but it's true. Whatever else is going on in our lives, sitting together in a room and writing a song is always a good time, even when our work is bad.
In some ways, I think you're best known for your anthem songs, like New York, New York, or even And the World Goes Round. I think of as being a real anthem-like song. When you sit down to compose something that you know is going to be big and anthem-like, are you thinking about anything different than when you're sitting down to compose a ballad?
No, I think, at least speaking for myself, we just try to fill the moment. Each moment that you write for in the theater has its requirements, and you try to fulfill those requirements as honestly as you can, keeping the diction of the characters in mind and their real emotions. New York, New York is an example, though, of tearing up things and starting again. We wrote some songs for the movie New York, New York, and one of our assignments was to write a title song. And we brought it in and played it for Liza and Scorsese, and they liked it just fine. And Robert De Niro was there, who was starring in the movie, and I could see him over in the corner with Scorsese gesturing quite vehemently. And Scorsese came back and almost apologetically said that De Niro felt that the song was not a heavyweight enough song, and would we take another shot at it? Well, we were both highly insulted, of course, and but we said yes, and we were being very stuffy about it. Anyway, we went home and wrote the second version of New York, New York, which is the song that became very popular. The point of that story is that if it were not for Robert De Niro, we would never have had a hit song called New York, New York.
Start spreading the news, I'm leaving today. I wanna be a part of it. New York, these vagabond shoes are longing to stray and step around the heart of it. New York, New York, I want to wake up in the city that doesn't sleep. King of the hill, ha, top of the heap. My little town blues are melting away. I'll make a brand new start of it in old New York. If I can make it there, I'd make
tricks to writing a big song like that, like key changes or movements up the octave or anything that you feel like you draw on when you're writing a big, triumphant kind of song?
I have absolutely no awareness of them. I'm sure there are, I'm sure there are plenty of cliches that I create for myself, but I don't know what they are. There are people who have said that there's a kind of Kander and Ebb style to a song, or they can recognize a Kander and Ebb song. Well, I couldn't. I have no idea what we do. I just know that at the end of writing a piece, I'm happy if I like it.
My guest is composer John Kander, half of the songwriting team Kander and Ebb. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Songwriter John Kander is my guest. You and Fred Ebb started writing for Broadway at a time when rock music was really displacing Broadway music as the pop music of the day. And even on Broadway, a few years after you started working, you know, shows of, like, I think of as ersatz rock music started taking over, shows like Hair. Do you feel that your kind of songwriting has been displaced at certain periods by rock music?
Well, yes, in one sense. When I was growing up, and even into the early days of my career, a great deal of what was popular music came from the theater. A hefty percentage of the song hits that swept the country came out of Broadway theater. Then, when rock music took over commercially, I mean, songs were no longer extracted from Broadway musicals. The perfect example I can give you is that when I walked into my hotel room in Boston before the first performance of Cabaret, I turned on the radio while I was unpacking, and there were 5 songs on the radio from our show. There had already been that many records made. And at the first performance, the song Cabaret was already a hit. That was the last time anything like that happened. So I guess there is pop music and there's classical music, and then somewhere in some other category there is what we would have to call theater music.
Are there really significant ways that you think Broadway or the theater has changed since you started writing?
Sure. Fred and I and Jerry Herman and Steve Sondheim and our generation were the last generation to be able to get their work done and fail and then be able to get produced again. The theater was not nearly as expensive. There were a lot of very active, very imaginative producers around. That's changed, and I can think of a number of factors. The change in the music business, of course. The skyrocketing expenses of putting on a Broadway musical compared to 25 years ago. The fact that there is only one newspaper in New York now that matters critically. Now, whoever is working at the New York Times has the power to make or break a Broadway show, so that producers are terrified to do anything that they don't feel has a good chance of getting the approval of the New York Times.
When you're writing a song, do you dream the song until it's finished?
What do you mean by that?
Well, that you go to sleep and the song keeps playing and playing as you're trying
to
get to sleep.
Oh, yes. That's awful. And as a matter of fact, that goes on all during rehearsal. When I go out of town with a show or even when I'm in town rehearsing, I have a tape recorder next to my bed with a lot of chamber music on it, a lot of Brahms and a lot of Mozart, a lot of Schubert, something to erase my own music from my head so that I can go to sleep. I can remember when I was conducting musicals in stock in the 50s, whatever show I was rehearsing would go on in my head all night long, and I could not go to sleep until I'd gotten through the whole score in my head. And it was murder. I remember when I was doing, I was conducting South Pacific, and I finally got a technique. I would start from the beginning of the show, but I would race the tempo. And the overture went very, in my head, went very fast. I remember Happy Talk went so fast that you, I almost laughed when I got to it. Finally, I'd get to the end, and then I could go to sleep.
Does it sometimes make you, like, hate the songs that you like that you're writing because you can't knock it out of your mind?
No, because something else happens, to me anyway. Once the song is written and orchestrated and performed and the show has opened, it's gone. By gone, I mean a year after a show has opened, I can practically not play a single thing from it from beginning to end without the music in front of me. And I've been playing the piano all my life.
Mm-hmm.
It's... I don't know if Freddie agrees, feels this the same way that I do. I think he does. Once you finish something and somebody has sung it, it's gone. It's not yours anymore. And consequently, when you go back and listen to it, you can either like it or not like it, just as if it were somebody else's music.
So that's nice. That means you're probably not the kind of composer who feels that a singer has to perform a song exactly the way you wrote it.
No, that... In the theater, you get the performance that you want for that moment, and particularly if you've written the song to fulfill a particular moment, you know how you want it to sound. After that, it's fair game.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, too. Thanks a lot, Terry.
Composer John Kander, half of the songwriting team Kander and Ebb. Their collaboration is being celebrated in an off-Broadway review called And the World Goes Round. An original cast recording of the show is due out next month. I'm Marty Moscowane, sitting in for Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel. Coming up next on All Things Considered, we'll have the latest news of the Judge Clarence Thomas nomination. We'll also hear from a lawyer who defends clients who are charged with sexual harassment, how she goes about trying to defend them. Also, we'll have a report on the market for adoption of blonde babies, and a talk with humorist Dave Barry, who recounts his brush with the United States Supreme Court, how the only story ever suggested to him by an associate justice of the court was the only one that was kept out of two newspapers that subscribed to his column. And also, Barry gives some travel tips based on his new book, which he claims is the greatest travel guidebook ever written. Those stories coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Gary Marshall, who directed last year's big hit movie Pretty Woman, raised a lot of eyebrows when he cast his screen adaptation of Terrence McNally's off-Broadway hit Frankie and Johnny in The Clair de Lune. He chose glamorous Michelle Pfeiffer and Al Pacino to play the roles created by the much less glamorous Kathy Bates and Kenneth Walsh. Film critic Stephen Schiff tells us how it all worked out.
Let's say Frankie and Johnny the movie had stuck with Kathy Bates and Kenneth Walsh. And let's say, besides, that it had stuck to the original play's structure, in which we meet our hero and heroine already in bed together, their courting over, and their problems about to unfold. That would have been a much grittier movie, but it might not have worked as well as this one does. Remember the old Doris Day Rock Hudson comedies of the late 50s and early 60s? The ones in which she kept saying no, no, and he kept saying yes, yes. Irresistible force meets immovable object. It's one of the oldest plots in the book, and Frankie and Johnny spins it again. The result is working-class froth. Superficial, yes, but sweet and pleasant and even kind of bubbly. Al Pacino plays the Rock Hudson character, albeit a few links down the food chain. His Johnny is a convict just getting out of jail who goes to work as a short-order cook at the Apollo Diner. That's where he catches sight of Michelle Pfeiffer's waitress Frankie, the Doris Day, who guards her solitude like a treasure trove. The pattern is set early on. He chases, she flees, leaving a trail of attitude in her wake.
I need scrambled with bacon, two easy overs with sausage, and a Belgian waffle.
I'm Johnny.
Hi.
Who are you?
Frankie. These eggs don't look runny. Mr. De Leon likes them runny.
They look runny to me. They're pretty runny.
He's a regular.
Who can argue with that? And who can argue with you? Thy head is full of quarrel, like an egg is full of meat. William Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet. I'm reading it now. Act 3, scene 1. I can't find it now. Okay. Raw eggs coming up.
Not raw. Runny.
Too cute? Well, yes. Pacino's Johnny is the least hardened criminal who ever did time. His joie de vivre practically eats up the screen, and the way he trots out the fruits of his new love of learning in his Brooklyn growl, well, he has all the pat winsomeness of a prepackaged sitcom hero. But Michelle Pfeiffer's performance is something else again. Yes, she's too beautiful for the role, and her stringy hair and unmade-up eyes can't disguise it, but Pfeiffer finds genuine pain in Frankie's fear of entering a relationship. Whenever Pacino threatens to send the movie to the moon, her touching gravity pulls it back down to earth. Meanwhile, in the background, wonderful character actors shoot Terrence McNally's sharpest quips at one another. I especially like the priceless comedian Jane Morris as the diner's drabbest waitress, and the superb stage actor Nathan Lane, playing another stock sitcom character, the lonely heroine's understanding gay neighbor, but playing it to the hilt. Best of all is the usually regal Kate Nelligan, the poor man's Meryl Streep, joyfully putting on a cheap accent to play the vulgar, man-hungry waitress Cora. The characters are comic, but Marshall finds the pathos in them. Like Frankie and Johnny, everyone else in this movie goes home to four walls and take out food and the blue flicker of the TV. In his own lighter-than-air way, Marshall's trying to create a tableau of urban loneliness and despair. Mostly, though, he's trying to entertain us. And mostly, he succeeds. Even though something in the back of your mind tells you you can probably expect a swell new diner comedy called Frankie on next fall's TV schedule.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Our interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers and Amy Sallet, with help from Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shorrock. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscowain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, we talk about Tibet, its history, its politics, and its spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama. Our guest is Dr. Robert Thurman, the first American to be ordained as a Tibetan Buddhist monk. That and more on the next Fresh Air.